You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
It's Monday, April 22nd, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And Mike Johnson's in trouble. He just passed the giant funding bill, a lot of money to Ukraine, a lot of money to Israel, the Indo-Pacific region, that means Taiwan, and Republicans don't like it. Most Republicans didn't vote with their speaker, even though, as I heard one Republican, Tom Cole of Oklahoma, saying there, the dynamic going on might be vote no, hope yes. Anyway, Johnson tweeting about the tenuous position that he is, thanks to rules passed under the McCarthy administration, Mike McCarthy, since the beginning of the 118th Congress, i.e. McCarthy, the House rule allowing a motion to vacate from a single member has harmed this office and our House majority. Recently, many members have encouraged me to endorse a new rule to raise this threshold. While I understand the importance of that idea, any rule change requires a full majority of the full House, requires a majority of the full House. What happens is I always think about DJ and Dave Coulier whenever I see that. I get a little confused. Anyway, he acknowledges they don't have a majority of the full House. We will continue to govern under the existing rules. So what's going on is he's subtweeting. Is it sub-Xing now? I don't know. The idea that, hey, Democrats or maybe some Republicans, help me pass this rule change to get the crazy bomb throwers of the Marjorie Taylor Greene, Paul Gosar ilk off my back. Now, here's my advice to Democrats. Democrats, hearken to the advice of Mike. I know many Democrats think that it is in their interest, and this is probably true, to have the Republicans in disarray. You run for election, you're a Democrat, you say, look at all these Republicans, you have a higher chance of winning. That may be true, and that informs some of the decisions when the Democrats refuse to back or break the logjam that actually wound up electing Mike Johnson. But it's not so much a thank you to Mike Johnson for passing this necessary funding bill. It's an acknowledgement that in this case, someone, I'm not even going to say someone you could work with. Mike Johnson is not a moderate. He certainly is hard right. He's certainly a MAGA Republican, but someone who can occasionally be sane enough to give you and America what you want that just might be better than the alternative. The alternative being chaos that's embarrassing to the Republicans, but also bad for any future agenda. And there is going to be a future agenda that Democrats themselves want to pass. Now, here's what's really interesting. Who is the kind of Democrat who would be least likely to back a Republican? That would be the far left or just the left of the Democratic Party. This guy is too MAGA. I'm not going to cast my votes for that guy. But the person who's very far left, they're also most likely in the safest districts. So the idea that we're going to hurt ourselves by taking away an opportunity to get more Democrats elected, that doesn't really affect those particular leftist Democrats. The Democrats who would most likely benefit from having Johnson tossed out and more chaos and a do-nothing Congress to run against, those are moderates. Now, moderates, by inclination, might also be the most prone to say, yeah, we could work with Johnson, not so much as a thank you, but just in terms of moderation and realism. So it's a little bit interesting. I do think that the Democrats in this case should back Mike Johnson. And we know that the Democrats almost always listen to me. So it's going to work out for a grateful nation. On the show today, chaos at Columbia, the college, not the country. Though, if we pivoted, there's a lot of chaos in the country too. But first, this is the second part of my interview with Damon Linker, who writes the Notes from the Middle Ground Substack. Wait, where was the first part, Mike? I didn't hear it Friday. We ran it on Saturday. That's the kind of, talk about chaos. That's the sort of thing we did. By someone who once taught a class at the Columbia School of Journalism. That'd be me. So Damon Wrote an op-ed for the New York Times titled, "Why is Biden Struggling? Because America is Broken." And in this interview, we will talk about brokenism. We'll talk about the very idea of the Democrats doing a lot better than even maybe some of them thought that they would do in the midterm. Did that redound to their benefit? All of this with Damon Linker up next. So you've heard me say, perhaps in an ad in the recent past, that first we make our habits, then they make us. That is a quote attributed to the English poet John Dryden. I believe he was the first poet laureate. It is poetic. First we make our habits, then they make us. Let's talk about the inverse of that. What do we do when we want to get rid of a habit? What about when we think our habits are, let us say, unmaking us? Enter a product I'm here to talk to you about. It's called Fume. Fume is not a vapor. It's flavored air. So what it does is it takes one habit that maybe you're trying to kick and replace it with a behavior that has the look and feel of that habit, but not the detriments. It's pleasant. It's similar. It's replacing a bad habit with a different, more positive behavior. And now, with all orders, you could buy one, get one on their cores, which are their different flavorings. You could stock up throughout the year, these cold winter months. Something to do, something to exhale, flavored air. So nice. And as a listener of The Gist, you'll get an extra 10% off when you use the code. Head to tryfume.com/thegist and use the code THEGIST for an additional 10% off, plus BOGO cores to help start making the good habit that much easier. Thank you, Shaka Smart.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Joining me once more is Damon Linker. He writes the Notes from the Middle Ground Substack. And in this continuation of our conversation, which was taped before the votes this weekend funding Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, in this part of the conversation, we talk or expand on our talk about brokenism, the idea that institutions just aren't working for America and Americans, and it's causing consternation and affects our politics. And I started by asking him, well, what about this idea? And I hear it a lot, that conservatism is the party of small government. And so there is a vested interest, indeed a strategy, in conservatives having government not work well. If the idea is the government that governs best governs least, govern the least, and what we're interpreting as government not working is just a demonstration, a purposeful demonstration of the idea that these things don't work out well, we're better off without it. What about that idea?
No, that, I mean, I get the argument. I know where it's coming from, that like gridlock is good, that kind of thing. But we have gone so far beyond gridlock. I mean, we're now at the point where, you know, the Republicans have a very narrow majority in the House and they can barely govern because everything has to be passed with the Hastert rule. So like everyone has to, that basically says that a majority of the majority has to be on anything for it to get to the floor. And it's just the level of overwhelming support that is expected by especially the Republican Party in order to get anything done is, I mean, the fact is we still have problems as a society and we have voters who have things they want the government to accomplish. And if you don't ever get anything done, what you've ended up really accomplishing is just showing that representative government isn't working, that you're not translating public opinion into the outcomes of what the government is trying to do and what it is doing. And that, I think, is in the end, it breeds a kind of nihilism and a real kind of pessimism about the capacity of the country to govern itself democratically. I think it contributes paradoxically in the end, not to like limited government. It actually makes authoritarianism more appealing, because then you start thinking, well, what we really need is a Mussolini to come in and make the trains run on time. Yeah. And you know, obviously Trump is a real threat for that, but Democrats love that rhetoric too. You hear that a lot from people, you know, on the left who are like, oh yeah, we should just ignore what the Republicans are saying and just use executive orders to govern. That's neither of those are good.
Do you think if you assess our situation right now, where the Republicans have such a slim advantage, and this gives powers to the representatives Gates and Massey's and Taylor Greene's, can we say that even the Democrats, they couldn't have known it then, but they would have been better off doing less well, losing a few more seats, maybe 12 more seats to the Republicans, thus giving whoever the Speaker of the House was a bigger cushion, and they could actually get things done. And not just Republican things done. Funding for all the countries that everyone except seven people want to fund. So that's my question. Like, I'm not saying it was a strategy or we should have advised Democrats not to do well, but is that how it actually wound up playing out?
Well, certainly the narrower the margin between the parties, the kind of the narrower the gate you have to get through. So I think even in a situation where the parties weren't as ideologically opposed as they are, it would be rough having a speaker with only a 5-vote majority or a 3-vote majority, or now down to 1 or 2, depending on who's out with a cold at any given time. And that's going to be a challenge, because that's so narrow. However, I do think that it would depend on who those extra 12 Republicans would be in your counterfactual, because
right, but usually it's moderates who lose to Democrats. So those are the sort of seats that we could rely on.
Right. And, you know, it isn't just seven. I mean, if you look at public opinion polling on, say, funding Ukraine, like there is a lot of negativity about funding Ukraine. I mean, there are a lot of Republicans. Support for that is down to, the last I saw, around 30% of Republicans actually want to be funding Ukraine and its war against Russia, or with defending itself against Russia. And so if the Republicans had 12 more seats, but they were 12 people who were in that camp, then it would be even less likely that you would get a vote on the funding issue. So I just think the Republican Party is very deeply divided on what it wants to do in foreign policy right now. And so that's one area where it's extremely hard to get to that unanimous vote minus 1 or 2 on this issue. So what you're probably going to end up happening if you know what's going on right now with the Speaker of the House trying to get a vote actually on the floor, what you're probably going to end up getting is a lot of Democrats with some Republicans passing that funding finally at the end of all these months. But that could ruin Johnson, the Speaker. I mean, he could end up getting he could end up getting kicked out and having his leadership stripped from him because of all the anger that would come up from having this pass with mostly Democratic support. But he's had to govern like that since he became Speaker, because his own side can't get together on pretty much anything.
So I think we both agree that our major problem with our politics is our people. It's not a problem. It's understandable. We are constantly in bummer mode and we don't see progress. We don't feel progress. We don't have politicians who could communicate progress, stipulated. But there are often reforms that are proposed, reforms of our system that the reformers claim would have miraculous to at least salubrious effects. I'll give you three: filibuster reform, gerrymandering reform, and just weakening the strength of the parties. You want to take on any of those that you think are overrated or underrated?
Well, you know, filibuster reform is, I have no principled objection to that. The filibuster is a bizarre institution. Its history is rooted in the South and segregation and making compromises with the South. And it's kind of a stupid thing, but I think that if Democrats are going to favor getting rid of it, they really need to think through the possibilities in the future, because it is a way for the minority to kind of block the ambitions of the majority. And so if whenever a party's in the minority, they like it more. So it, Democrats love the idea of getting rid of it because they actually want to do things. They actually have agendas that they want to pass, and they get very frustrated that the Republicans can continually block them. But, you know, it's a tool. And so I would want to know that the Democrats have really thought through, well, what are we going to do the next time, you know, we're in a position where it would be really helpful to be able to stop the Republicans from doing bad shit. And now we can't do it because we don't have the filibuster anymore. So that's my take on that. Other stuff, you know, I actually don't think we need weaker parties. I think we need stronger parties. I think our parties are basically empty husks at this point. They're very powerful in the sense that they're rallying flags for voters to kind of rally around. But as institutions, they're essentially hollow. They have no capability of having really any influence at all. And this was demonstrated by the ease with which Trump took over the Republican Party. He basically just went over the head of the party institution to the voters and spoke directly to them. And they ignored what the party wanted, all those other 16 people up there on the debate stage in 2016. And they went for Trump. So I actually think that would be better. I mean, in general, my view is I'm in favor of any institutional reform you want to pass, provided you do it by following the Constitution. But I don't want people to do it thinking it's a magic bullet. Our problem in this country fundamentally is public opinion. We don't agree about stuff. There are two very different visions of what we want the country to be, what its history is, the direction we would like to go, or the direction we hate we did go. And as long as we disagree about those things, we could have a parliamentary system. We could have, you know, 18 parties. We could have four parties. We could have our two parties. And none of that is going to fundamentally change it. I mean, look what happened in Israel before Netanyahu finally actually won a majority the last time. They had like five elections in 3 years because every time they would have it, The parties were so divided that it was impossible to form a coherent government. That doesn't happen in our system because we don't have a multi-party system. It happens at a different level, basically, in how the parties organize the factions within them. And so that happens before we hold a vote. But those disagreements are still going to be there. And so there is no magic bullet that you kind of change the rules and suddenly we're electing, I don't know, like all centrist, moderate centrists, like we like to imagine it used to be.
Yeah.
Back when we had Bill Clinton, center left, very moderate guy, who the Republicans hated. And then, you know, someone on the right who, like, you know, in the scheme of Trump, like George W. Bush seems like so moderate. Like the guy who passed the big like AIDS bill to help stop AIDS in Africa, that nice guy, the guy who like passed a Medicare Part D prescription drug benefit like a Democrat, that George W. Bush who the left hated. I mean, that's why I say like it's kind of interesting. Like, when was it that we all got along? I guess in the 50s.
Yeah, Eisenhower was doing pretty good.
Eisenhower was the good old days.
Basically, you have to have a world war to look back and say, yeah, it really was worse then. That I'll give you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you have a global depression and then
right. Followed by the greatest economic expansion and television. And,
right.
Yeah,
and like how many 40 million people slaughtered in World War II on the battlefield? Yeah.
Those
are
the conditions.
After that, everything seems like it's not so bad.
Right. So here's my last question or my last theme, and it's the classic, let's end the interview with an optimistic note as we look to the future. I'm not going to do that. I draw optimism from not looking to the future, but you frequently highlight a lot of the great thinkers of the past, political scientists, and I am optimistic to know, oh, we've been thinking about this for so long. This has always been a problem. This has always been a problem that trenchant analysis from the 50s, 60s, 70s can apply to. So I'll tee you up. What do you like about Isaiah Berlin?
Well, yeah, he's one of my heroes, influenced by several writers, but Isaiah Berlin is right near the top for me. I like that Berlin doesn't think that morality and our moral and political convictions really adds up. He thinks that, like, moral experience is like a shattered mirror. It's all kind of creates a coherent image where you can look at yourself in it and you can kind of discern yourself, but it's broken into shards in the sense that he recognizes, and I think this is just profoundly and undeniably true, that there are many valuable, worthwhile moral ideals, but they conflict with each other. They're in tension. Liberty, freedom, wonderful moral ideal, but it has a few senses. There's negative liberty, like freedom from government, and then there's positive liberty, your ability to pursue the ends that you want without limitation. So having the money that you need to do things, the opportunities to help you get ahead in life. But then those different notions of freedom stand in tension with equality. Equality is a great noble ideal as well. But yet, if you have a free society, sometimes you're going to generate inequality because people aren't the same in all respects. Some people have more talent than others, and they're going to rise to the top, and you're going to have an unequal society. So then maybe you have some redistribution to kind of make it a little more equal. But if you have too much, then you no longer have freedom. And similarly with other ideals that go along with it, too, like solidarity, community, belonging to a group. That's a wonderful thing, except when it becomes corruption because you're always giving your own friends all the benefits and screwing the other people in the other group. There are ways of looking forward and up to ideals of like sanctity, purity of moral pursuit. That's very noble and admirable. But if you're too pure and too sanctimonious, you end up maybe becoming like a suicide bomber who's willing to die for your cause. You're so great, so wonderful and pure in your noble cause that you're like outside of the normal standards of right and wrong. Mm-hmm. And so I could go on and on, but the idea is each of those is like one of those shards in that mirror. And somehow human moral experience is all of them together, and we have to recognize and create a politics that is willing to accept the pluralism of all these different moral concerns and recognize that they conflict, and you're constantly having to balance, do trade-offs among them. And that willingness to do that is what I associate as liberalism at its best. To be liberal is to be open to and acknowledge and respond to the tensions and contradictions in all the goods of life when they conflict. And that, I think, is a key to how we can all, you know, ideally, how we can all get along in a society of 330 million people trying to form a single political community.
And maybe, if I may, maybe the reason you're a centrist, if you, to the extent that you adopt that label, is that when you think about Berlin's tensions, that the answer isn't always at the mean, but a tendency to think for answers or to actually weigh these things as being virtues in balance and know that, you know, even in physics, a fulcrum isn't always exactly at the center. You have to think about the balance of each side. But that's at least a very useful exercise to apply to most of these tensions that we have to deal with.
When people in our public life are arguing their case in good faith, I find myself very often thinking, you know, you had a good point. That person had a good point. Whether they're Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, or liberals, wherever they are, on the spectrum. And I have my own convictions. I tend to fall center left on most issues. But I often, you know, in debate about tax policy or welfare policy or healthcare policy, whatever it is, foreign policy, I often think the other side has a point and it should be incorporated into what we try to do in the direction that I would prefer. And, you know, that's something that another great post-war liberal, Lionel Trilling, would always say, that he would quote J.S. Mill, John Stuart Mill, and how he had very productive friendships with a conservative of his time named Samuel Taylor Coleridge, a great poet who was a conservative in the mid-19th century, which by today's standards, that's really conservative. But the great liberal theorist Mill said that it was very good for his liberalism to hear the objections of a thoughtful conservative to his views, and it made his liberalism stronger. That's the sense in which I'm a liberal, and therefore a kind of centrist in my liberalism, because I'm open to what the other side has to say. Again, not when I'm being, you know, mocked and goaded by the trolls on the right who see themselves gaining an advantage by pissing me off and getting me to say something stupid in anger against them that they can then weaponize as part of their big political campaign, but in an actual debate among people who care about these things and the truth and the common good.
Damon Linker's Substack is called Notes from the Middle Ground. It subsumes smaller Substacks like Eyes on the Right, Looking Left, Above the Fray. He does all of these. He analyzes the left. He analyzes the right. He hovers above it and offers insight. Notes from the Middle Ground is where to find him. Damon, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Now the spiel. No classes were held today on the campus of Columbia University in New York after an encampment of pro-Palestinian protesters was cleared by decree of the president last Thursday. That included the arrest and expulsion of some students. The campus erupted afterwards to such a degree that the White House weighed in, condemning with the words, quote, "While every American has the right to peaceful protest, calls for violence and physical intimidation targeting Jewish students in the Jewish community are blatantly anti-Semitic, unconscionable, and dangerous. They have absolutely no place on any college campuses or anywhere in the United States of America." Now, the phrase that I used, "the campus erupted," that was disputed by several allies of the protesters. On the day of the arrest, which was Thursday, the arrested students were certainly upset, but the NYPD described them in kinder terms than I've ever heard the NYPD describe any detainee. Chief John Chell said, quote, "The students that were arrested were peaceful, offered no resistance whatsoever, and were saying what they wanted to say in a peaceful manner. This despite the NYPD being linked to the KKK in chants by students."
KKK, Iowa, they're all the same. NYPD, KKK, Iowa.
After the arrests, things did not die down. Non-Columbia students were not allowed on campus, so they took to the streets nearby, right outside the gates of the campus. One group of anti-Israel protesters, which might have included Columbia students or might not have, assembled in a subway entrance servicing Columbia and chanted, among other sentiments, if you can't hear it, was "burn Tel Aviv to the ground" and "go Hamas, we love you, we support your rockets too." On campus, Jewish students were harassed, according to an article printed less than 24 hours ago in the Columbia Spectator, the student newspaper. Quote, "According to a video taken Saturday, reviewed by the Spectator, a pro-Palestinian protester on campus near 116th Street and Amsterdam Avenue tried to burn an Israeli flag, and another individual appeared to throw an object at the head of Jonathan Lederer, College 26, who was part of a group of counter-protesters. You have blood on your hands, one person shouted. You're a genocidal maniac, another said. The Spectator also reported interactions between Columbia students stepping outside of campus, being subjected to the chants of, quote, "stop killing children" and "go back to Poland, go back to Belarus," a reference to the locations of concentration camps and death camps. And outside the gates, protesters also chanted, "Yehudim, Yehudi, Jews, Jew, fuck you." On campus, a Jewish student wearing a yarmulke said he was screamed at by another Columbia student, saying, "We are so happy that you Zionists are finally leaving campus." None of this is nice. None of this is orderly. But is it anti-Semitic? Well, of course it's anti-Semitic, concluded the White House, the university president, a Columbia-affiliated rabbi who advised all Jewish students to leave campus out of safety concerns, and, to pick one somewhat prominent voice, Alexis Onion, who is the co-founder of Reddit. He's the husband of tennis great Serena Williams. I don't know why I follow him on X, but he's always vocal about progressive causes, and he was about this. He tweeted, X'd, "The videos coming out of Columbia are vile. Peaceful protest is an American right, but this anti-Semitism ain't it. It was just as vile when the right was chanting, 'Jews will not replace us' at UVA. Now that it's coming from the left doesn't make it okay." And he linked to a protester outside the campus gates yelling at two Columbia students who were Jewish. And what this guy is saying, never forget the 7th of October. This will not happen one more time, not five more times, not 10, 100, 1,000, but 10,000 more times. Ohanian was told that no, this wasn't anti-Semitism. It was anti-Zionism. Anti-Zionism is a political critique. It's not attacking an ethnicity. To quote one of the people telling him this in his thread, Sana Saeed, who describes herself as a media critic, she works for Al Jazeera, and she expressed this view and added, also, let's remember how many, quote, anti-Semitic incidents over the past few months on campuses were found to be done by pro-Israeli agitators. So I guess pointing out all the sneaky Jews behind those numerous operations, that's also not anti-Semitic. It's only anti-Zionist, so it's okay. Saeed, and this is a side note, but I thought it was interesting, took to Twitter to criticize Malala, the Nobel Prize winning Malala, for Broadway producing a musical along with Hillary Clinton. Okay, I'm getting sidetracked by the critiques of one media critic who hosts or produces a media criticism show on Al Jazeera. But that distinction between anti-Semitism and Zionism is an interesting one. You can be anti-Zionist and not anti-Semitic. Take Marek Edelman. He was a Jewish participant in the Warsaw Ghetto uprisings. He fought the Nazis. He somehow survived. He refused to leave Poland. He criticized the idea of Zionism as unworkable. He was an anti-Zionist, and of course, he was not an anti-Semite, a devout Jew all his life. For any one of him, though, there are dozens, hundreds, thousands of anti-Semites and anti-Zionists. They might not literally hate Jews who support their anti-Zionist cause, who maybe are in the ranks of college campus protest groups, but with the slenderest application of discernment or just thinking about it, it is hard to defend a lot of the anti-Israel rhetoric if it calls for the murder of the Jews who happen to be Israelis, or burning cities full of Jews just because those cities happen to be Israeli. It's hard not to call that anti-Semitic. It's anti-Semitic. But I saw even the calls to violence that don't say Jew or reference Holocaust death camps. Sometimes they're clever enough or sophisticated enough, which isn't to say sophisticated, not to assail the Jews. They only assail Zionism. And so often that's seen as a get out of anti-Semitism free card. Of course, to go back to what Alexis Ohanian was saying, there were differences between the Unite the Right rally and the protesters around Columbia. You know, even the guy promising 10,000 more October 7th. Big difference. In Virginia, they touted guns. That's not allowed in New York City. In Virginia, Heather Heyer was run over and killed. Nothing close to that has happened at Columbia or any of these protests, as far as I'm aware. But a huge difference is that neo-Nazis and neo-Confederates are dumb, or at least they're purposefully confrontational, or so unsophisticated as to how they work with the mainstream media, which they don't want to work with, that they know not to assail the Jews as Jews per se. But if you replace that one-syllable word with the multisyllabic Zionist, and you earn, in the minds of many anti-Zionists, sufficient distance to evade the charge of anti-Semitism. There are positions or statements against the actions of Israel that clearly are not anti-Semitic, saying stop the war, cease fire now, save the innocents, critiquing Netanyahu, critiquing the conduct of the war. But calling for harm to come to Jewish people because they're supporters of Israel or live in Israel or you perceive them to support Israel, spewing venom against someone who is an identifiable Jew because you see in them a connection to Israel, that is anti-Semitism. You could argue, no, it's just an attempt to confront Israelis, but it shows up, it's experienced as, it's, I think, indistinguishable from a confrontation of Jews because they are Jews. I mean, that is why you are confronting them. They are Semites, you are anti them and their affiliations. The protesters or the sympathizers to their cause could tell themselves, no, it's really just because they're Zionists, not because they happen to be Jews. And Zionists, per se, are, in fact, legitimate targets for vitriol, since they perpetuate this horrible system. That's what anti-Zionists would have us believe. But I disagree. I think Zionists does not necessarily mean a supporter of all the decisions, most of the decisions, the latest decisions of Israel. Zionists just believes in the existence of Israel as a country and homeland for Jewish people. And that's a political stance, and that was debated by the United Nations. And so what am I saying? In 1947, you can't take a stance that this whole idea of how they're creating Israel is poor, a bad idea, will lead to bad execution, to do so is anti-Semitic. No, I wouldn't say that. But I would say in 2024, with 6 million Jewish people living as a result of the decisions made many generations ago, that if you are engaged in the kind of anti-Zionism that says the Zionist entity, which is what the enemies of Israel call Israel, if you are saying that should never have existed and shouldn't exist now, you are necessarily calling for the displacement or maybe the death of millions of Jews. That's pretty close to anti-Semitism. One problem I have is that in America, any identity-based offense is verboten. It's antithetical to our shared values, we hope. In many cases, it's a violation of equal protection laws. But if the smear or insult is morally unconscionable on a basis other than identity, then we seem to lose our ability to castigate it. I don't think we should. I think we should retain that. I would put in the camp of unconscionable, unacceptable, and in all practical terms, very close to, if not totally embodying, anti-Semitism. Any applause of Hamas, cheering the deaths of Israelis, calling for the deaths of more Israelis, endorsement of a terrorist organization dedicated to killing Israelis is supporting the killing of Israelis, Jewish Israelis. I guess it's a little attenuated, but we're smart, discerning people. We can look at that, we should be able to, and say, yeah, that's anti-Semitic. You could argue that, oh no, it's a political stance, but I think you'd be arguing for politics that is anti-Semitic. So what protections should we offer as a campus, as a society? I mean, I have some sympathy, but I also have a little annoyance with Jews on campus who right now are feeling under assault and saying, we want all the protections that you've given everyone else. We want the ideology that you extended to everyone else in the past. It's totally understandable that they are saying now, what about words of violence? What about safetyism? What about this idea of stochastic terrorism, which is to say that insult words will, of course, transmogrify into violence little by little, by degrees, but surely. They say, offer me the shade of that umbrella. It is understandable. This is the message of the universities. But on this point, I'm influenced by something that was said by UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh. He was on the Views on First podcast put out by the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. Speech needs to be protected, says the First Amendment scholar Eugene Volokh. And then he brings up the concept of some speech where you have to strain to find the offense. Sometimes this is called microaggressions. And he pivots off that to make the following point.
Yes, well, wait a minute. They're essentially being hypocritical in this sort of thing, that for years we were told that microaggressions, minor insensitivities based on race or religion or sex, including some things that most people wouldn't even view as race, religion, sex-based insensitivities or sexual orientation-based insensitivities, are something that needs to be condemned and also, in fact, could lead to disciplinary measures because they're viewed as a form of subtle racism or sexism and therefore possibly harassment and such. And now, when people are essentially praising the murder of Israelis, well, that's protected speech. Now, my view is, if you're going to try to equalize, you should equalize in favor of more speech rather than less speech. This is what I call sometimes censorship envy, that some people say essentially, well, the speech that is offensive to other groups is being censored. So now I'm going to ask for the speech that's offensive to my group to be censored too, because I want equality of censorship. I envy the protection that the censorship is giving the other groups. I don't want to equalize it to more censorship. I want to equalize it to more free speech.
Agreed. But the hard part for the macro-aggressed Jewish students is the notion that, oh, now is the time we equalize. Yeah, I get it. But I also say, yes, I think we should. I do think that everyone on campus now, once some basic rules are established and once imminent threats are addressed, everyone will have to put up with some degree of discomfort. Everyone will have to put up with speech that gives offense, that needs to be heard because people feel it needs to be said. Let's take calling Israel an apartheid state. I do not think this is an apt point. You've heard me say that. But it is a point that a university absolutely can't shut down. Same thing with the charge of genocide. If the schools, if our society had a clearer understanding of the need for more speech, and was pretty strict about designating what is legitimately intimidating speech, I'm not going to say we'd be having an easy time of it right now. These campuses have absolutely become powder kegs. But I do think that when the powder settles, and it will, the rulemakers will be able to say, well, we navigated as justly and as guided by principles as was possible in a hostile time. And that's it for today's show. The quaint Mallards are Corey Wara and Joel Patterson, one the producer, one the senior producer, respectively. Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Thanks for listening.